Faith is believing in something you can't see, you can't feel, something that can't be proven.
So then how do you know which is the right faith?
I think that's a gut thing.
I don't think about a right faith. I think about what resonates with me. I feel authentic. It brings me peace.
I think there is no absolute truth in any religion. I think it's a matter of subjective experience.
I kind of just trust my intuition, trust my gut.
You just know. You just gotta follow it.
You just gotta follow what you think is your faith.
If faith is blind, then what makes one belief better or worse than any other? And if it's just a leap in the dark, why should any of us feel obligated to believe anything at all? My name is Shane Rosenthal. I was raised in a Jewish home, but became an atheist at a very young age. Later, as I began to question things, I ended up losing faith in my atheism and converted to Christianity. Since that time, I've never stopped asking questions, and I've spoken with authors and scholars from all over the world in order to explore the beliefs and ideas that shape our lives. Over the years, one thing I've concluded is this. We're all believers. But because there are so many conflicting ideas and worldviews out there, we just can't all be right. So how do we find the truth? On this podcast, we'll start by asking questions.
I'm really just trying to figure out what I believe right now.
Hey there, welcome to another episode of the Humble Skeptic Podcast. On the last episode, I aired part of a conversation I recorded with Cambridge New Testament scholar Richard Bauckham, related to his thesis that the Gospels should be seen not as oral stories that evolved over time, but as eyewitness testimony written by Jesus' disciples and those in their company. On this program, I'll be airing the second part of my conversation as we focus more specifically on the fourth Gospel, which Dr. Bauckham has written about extensively. Many scholars over the last two centuries have attempted to argue that because John was the last gospel to be published, it was likely the least historically reliable. According to Richard Bauckham, however, when the Gospel of John is studied closely, the author is clearly writing as an eyewitness, and many of the things he says about life in first century Judea have been corroborated by numerous ancient sources. One of the first things I asked Professor Bauckham to discuss was his claim that the Gospel of John essentially reads like a trial narrative. So I asked him to explain why this is significant.
There's a lot of legal language in John. There are a whole series of witnesses. You know, John the Baptist is a witness, Scripture is a witness, God the Father is a witness, Jesus' works are a witness. He's constantly citing witnesses to his claims about who he is. John's Gospel, I think, is very much focused on who Jesus is. And so there is a kind of trial going on in which, you know, various characters put objections to what Jesus says, or very often they misunderstand what Jesus says. You've got a whole dialogue going on around the figure of Jesus, and then you get a sort of vindication of Jesus at the end. So I think it explains quite a lot of how the work is structured, and some of this language. There's a lot of language of witness and testimony scattered through the Gospel. And of course, the last witness is the beloved disciple himself, the author of the Gospel, who in the very last couple of verses of the Gospel says that he's the disciple who's witnessed these things. And so in a sense, he's the key witness because all the other witnesses we have in his book. So he's the witness who, as it were, gives us all the other witnesses in literary form.
But you don't actually think that that's a literary device or just a motif. You actually think that the author of this text is presenting real evidence for the reader's consideration by means of actual historical eyewitnesses. Why are you convinced of that?
Yes, I do think that. We use the word witness outside a court context. And I think the same is happening. You know, the court context is a metaphor, but it really is about actual witness. Why do I think John's based on eyewitness testimony? Well, I think it claims to be quite clearly. Famous verse in the prologue that says, we have seen his glory. And at a couple of points, the disciple Jesus loved, as he's called in the Gospel, is said to be the disciple who witnesses to these things. So I think it makes a claim initially to eyewitness testimony by the beloved disciple himself, who then claims to record for us these other witnesses. So I think the eyewitness claim is very clear. And I think so many scholars have thought, for various reasons, this cannot be written by an eyewitness. And so they've tended to say that, you know, the last couple of verses of the Gospel don't really mean what they say. that somehow the eyewitness testimony is, you know, got way back behind a long process that produced the gospel. But I think it says rather clearly that it's the disciple who wrote these things. So I think we should take it at face value. And the alternative, of course, is to say that the whole thing is a fraud and he's pretending to be an eyewitness, though he isn't. And then there are various arguments one could make about the historical plausibility. Another feature of John's gospel, which I think is often missed, is the features of John's gospel that correspond to the way that ancient people wrote history in that period. For example, John is very precise about topography. It's a very striking feature of the gospel if you start looking out for it. You always know more or less where Jesus is. You often know precisely where Jesus is.
He's not just there at the temple, but he's there by the sheep gate with the place of five porticos called Bethesda.
Exactly. Or he's in Solomon's portico in the temple, or he's in the temple treasury, and so on. You know, especially the Jerusalem locations are very specifically noted. And again, if you compare that with the Synoptic Gospels, they're often really quite vague about where Jesus is. You know, he's on a hill somewhere in Galilee, or this happened on the way to Jerusalem. And this is one of the things ancient people expected of good historiography. It should be precise about topography and about chronology. And again, John is precise about chronology because he has this series of Jewish feasts in the temple. They mark out, as it were, the period of Jesus' ministry, and everything else is dated in relation to them. So you always know within a few months, and often more precisely, exactly at what point in the story you are. So I think there are features of John that ancient readers would have found making a claim to be historical literature, not a kind of theology dressed up as a story, or, you know, various other ways in which modern scholars have tried to explain it.
And so you say all these place names and all these identification markers give this particular witness credibility. And if he has credibility, then you trust his witness.
Yes, exactly. Often, of course, because of the basic question that I think everyone who looks hard at the Gospels has to have some sort of answer to, which is, why is John's Gospel different? I mean, there's no doubt, of course, that John has theological interests. Of course he does. That's why he's writing. He's concerned about who Jesus is and about the salvation that Jesus brings. Also, you see, John's theological claim is that the Word became flesh. The Son of God entered real human history as a real human person. So in a sense, his theological claim requires him to be writing history.
Interesting.
Otherwise, the theology would be, you know, emptied of its meaning if it didn't have a genuine historical content.
So you just mentioned that in the beginning is the Word who becomes flesh. There are some who have made the claim that John here is sort of writing an apologetic to Greeks as he's interacting with this idea of the Logos. Others argue, actually, the more we study the Jewish background and context to this idea of the Word, then you realize this is actually a very Jewish idea. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yes, and I think even ordinary readers can verify that by comparing the beginning of John's Gospel with the beginning of Genesis, because it very clearly deliberately echoes the beginning of Genesis. Genesis begins, "In the beginning God created." John's Gospel begins, "In the beginning was the Word," and then it goes on to talk about creation. So I think there's a very clear allusion to creation, and initially the obvious meaning of Word is the Word that God spoke in Genesis to create the world. And so John says the world came into being through him, through the Word. So that corresponds very closely to Genesis. And then remember that Genesis goes on to talk about light and darkness, and so does the prologue to John. So Genesis is the obvious background, which is why when I talk about the prologue, I actually talk about the Word rather than the Logos. I think the Logos, because it's a Greek word which has a whole lot of additional meaning, is probably a bit misleading. Logos was a kind of well-known word, you know, with a sort of philosophical content in the ancient world. So John may have been aware, you know, that pagans who were familiar with that would pick up that connection as well. But I think if that's true, it has to be very, very secondary. And one of the things John is doing in the prologue, actually, is to root his Christology in Jewish monotheism. And Jewish monotheism was very much about distinguishing the Creator from all the things that God created. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. You know, why does he have to say that so elaborately twice? Because that's the key point he's trying to make. So I think he wants Jewish readers to see how his Christology is rooted in the Hebrew Scriptures, and doesn't contradict them, but can be seen to grow out of them. And the other thing the prologue does, you see, is it starts off talking about the Word. That term for Jesus Christ is not used anywhere else in the Gospel. It disappears after the prologue. It disappears halfway through the prologue. As soon as he says the Word became flesh, as soon as he refers to the Incarnation, he no longer uses the Word, and the Word becomes the Son. And of course, Son is what John's Gospel calls Jesus constantly throughout the Gospel. So in a way, he's saying to Jewish readers, you know who I'm talking about from the Hebrew Scriptures, the Word of God, but now he's been revealed as God's Son. So the prologue makes the transition from the Word of God in creation to the Son of God in incarnation.
And then we have seen his glory, the only one, you know, in the trial narrative that you find in Isaiah, the only one who has glory is Yahweh himself, who does not share his glory, but now we've seen it with our own eyes there at the beginning of John's Gospel.
Yes. And I think, you know, some people want to take that we to mean all Christians. All we Christians have seen glory. But I think it's clearly not that, because it goes on, it says, we have seen his glory and so on and so on. And from his grace, we have all received. So when he then, in a couple of verses later, wants to refer to all Christians, he has to say we all, showing that the we in we have seen his glory is a very restricted group of people, the eyewitnesses.
So in that respect, the language that we find, particularly the one you mentioned at the end of the gospel, this is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things. That also mirrors the language we find in John 19, where he says, he who saw the piercing of Jesus' side with the blood and water flowing, he who saw it has borne witness, his testimony is true. So the conclusion of the gospel seems to echo that same eyewitness language that you find there in John 19.
Yes, I think that's right. Those two passages are clearly sort of echo one another. And I think both of them, particularly the one at the end, echoes the prologue, we have seen his glory. So you've got an eyewitness claim actually right in the prologue, and then you've got an eyewitness claim at the end of the epilogue. So you kind of encircle the whole gospel.
Now, one of the points you make in your writings is that the author of this gospel is really the ideal witness to present a written gospel, particularly in that he was a witness to Jesus from the very beginning. In fact, you argue that he was there with Jesus even before Peter. Can you explain this point for our listeners?
Yes. Well, something you might not notice unless you read it quite carefully, when Jesus calls the first disciples at the end of chapter 1, these people who had been disciples of John the Baptist, who witnessed John the Baptist pointing out who Jesus is, and they're interested and they follow Jesus, and then they bring their friends along too. But these two original disciples are Andrew and another disciple who is not named. And then Andrew fetches his brother Peter, and we meet Philip and we meet Nathaniel. And then the unnamed disciple sort of drops out of the picture. And if you're not attending, you might just not notice that he's there, really, or not notice that he's disappeared. But it is a very odd fact, if you notice it, that here you have one of the very first disciples of Jesus who is not named. And I think the first-time reader of the Gospel would not really know what to make of that. But by the time you get to the end of the Gospel and you've got used to this figure who is called the disciple Jesus loved and is always anonymous, you can reasonably think that maybe this disciple there right at the beginning is that disciple. And of course, when Jesus first meets him, he cannot be called the disciple Jesus loved. Jesus hasn't had a chance to love him yet. So his sort of standard title later in the gospel cannot be used at the beginning. So I think he appears there right at the beginning. And there's a verse in the Last Supper discourses of Jesus where he refers to the disciples as witnesses. And he says, you are my witnesses, because you have been with me from the beginning. Now, the beloved disciple makes a big thing of his own witness to Jesus. It would be rather odd if he has Jesus saying that and he could not, as it were, include himself in those disciples who had been there from the beginning. So I think there's a good case for saying that that disciple who's anonymous at the beginning is in fact the beloved disciple.
Yeah, it wouldn't make sense at all if he kind of appears there at the Last Supper and then proclaims this witness material, including that verse there in John 15 saying the witnesses should be those who go back from the beginning. If he's only appearing there at the Last Supper for the first time, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
Doesn't make a lot of sense at all, no. And so it puts him there just before Peter. I mean, he's a disciple literally probably a few hours before Peter was. But interestingly, that pattern is replicated in the epilogue the other way around, so that in the epilogue you've got Jesus with Peter and the beloved disciple. Beloved disciple, you know, as it were, remains in the narrative for just a fraction of time after Peter at the end. So there's a kind of correspondence. You know, Peter and the beloved disciple are quite close. You know, they're paired in the narrative at certain points. But at both ends, you know, the beloved disciple claims to have this slight primacy over Peter as a witness. He was there just before Peter. He's still there a little after Peter. And the significance of his being there after Peter, of course, is that is the point where he goes on to say, this is the disciple's written these things. So he's there after Peter in the sense that he wrote down his witness and it survives as his gospel.
So basically what you're saying is the beloved disciple is the ideal witness because he has been there with Jesus from the beginning, and at these crucial moments, he was there at the tomb before Peter. He was there at the Last Supper sitting next to Jesus, whereas Peter has to motion to him saying, what did he say?
Yes, yes, exactly. Exactly, that's right, yes. And you know, he emphasizes how close he is to Jesus, which is probably a claim not simply to be able to report the events, but also to understand Jesus. Because I do think John's gospel is a more interpretive gospel than the others. And scholars have sometimes regarded that as showing John to be less historical than the others, as a kind of more theological interpretation of Jesus in John. But I think it's perfectly credible that someone who had been close to Jesus, and he's writing his gospel probably after all the others, and I think a claim, as it were, to be able to understand Jesus and to convey in various ways the significance he saw in Jesus' story is very credible on the part of an eyewitness who had been with Jesus and who valued his closeness to Jesus.
So you do argue that the Gospel of John was written by a trustworthy eyewitness who had been with Jesus from the beginning, but you also end up arguing that both according to the internal and external evidence, this author is not actually the Apostle John, the son of Zebedee.
Yes, and as you say, there are two distinct lines of discussion here. One concerns the evidence we have from early Christian writers after the gospel was written. The other evidence is from within the gospel itself. In other words, does the gospel itself portray the disciple Jesus loved as one of the 12? And a whole series of scholars in recent decades have argued that the beloved disciple in the gospel is portrayed as a disciple of Jesus who's not one of the 12. But I think I've, as it were, expanded and strengthened the case there. On the internal evidence, I think there are quite a few reasons to think this. The Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, focus on the 12 apostles, and they focus particularly on this inner circle of the 12, the three disciples, Peter, and the two sons of Zebedee, James and John, who appear with Jesus in scenes like the Transfiguration, where Jesus takes them apart from the others, so that those three are the only witnesses. So it looks very much as though the story in Mark is based on Peter's memories, which he shared with the other two of this inner circle of three, and to a lesser extent with the 12. John's gospel actually hardly mentions the 12, and certainly disciples appear in John's gospel who are not in the other gospels. There's Nathanael, for example, there's Nicodemus, there's Lazarus. These are quite important characters in John. We've not heard of them in the other gospels. And also there are disciples who appear in the other gospels as mere names in the list of the 12, like Philip and Thomas, who become important characters in John's gospel. So it does look as though the focus in John's gospel is on a different circle of disciples. And one of the key things one has to do, if you're looking at all four gospels, is to explain why John is different. And this, I think, is one of the reasons why John is different. He gives us the memories of Jesus that he himself and others within this particular circle, the disciples that he was close to, such as Nicodemus, such as Lazarus, and so forth. So the stories that don't appear in the other gospels appear in John. The other big contrast, of course, is that so much in John's gospel happens in Jerusalem, very little in Galilee.
Right. He comes from Galilee to the Jerusalem festivals, and it's situated mostly in Jerusalem, whereas in the Synoptic Gospels, most of the scenes are set in Galilee, right?
Exactly. Now, if you compare the role that the beloved disciple plays in John's Gospel, what we know about him, very little in common with the account of John the son of Zebedee. I mean, just one point that's really worth making, because people don't usually think about this when they think about who was the beloved disciple. In the Synoptic Gospels, John is always mentioned along with his brother James. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, they're an inseparable pair in the Synoptic Gospels. In John's Gospel, James does not appear at all until in chapter 21. Chapter 21 has a single reference to the sons of Zebedee. So both sons of Zebedee are named there. But if the beloved disciple is John, the son of Zebedee, we would expect his brother James to come into the picture from time to time at least, whereas he's notably absent from this narrative. So if people say, well, John, the son of Zebedee, was an important figure close to Jesus in the Synoptics, so surely he must be there in John's Gospel, and there's no other character he can be except the beloved disciple. To which I counter, James, the son of Zebedee, is just as important a character in the Synoptics, and he does not appear in the fourth Gospel. So the non-appearance of key people from the Synoptic Gospels in John's Gospel cuts both ways, actually. I don't think you can have it applying to John unless you also face the fact that James is not there.
Now, you also talk about John 21. You just mentioned that scene in which I think there are seven disciples total who are mentioned, five of whom are named, two of them being the sons of Zebedee. But then there are two anonymous disciples. You talk about that being a kind of bookend that mirrors the anonymous disciple there at the beginning. Can you talk about that and how you think it points to the fact that the author of this gospel is one of those two anonymous disciples mentioned there at the beginning of John 21?
Yes. I mean, if one thinks about the fact that the sons of Zebedee occur there and nowhere else, well, if he's going to just mention the sons of Zebedee, where more appropriate than on a fishing expedition? So it's not too surprising if the sons of Zebedee are not in the rest of the gospel, but they do crop up there. So you've got seven disciples, the sons of Zebedee, the others who are named, Nathaniel, Philip, and so forth, and the two unnamed disciples. So that all scholars who take the view that the beloved disciple is not one of the 12 see that the two anonymous disciples cover the appearance of the beloved disciple very soon in that narrative. So if the beloved disciple is not one of the sons of Zebedee, then he's one of the two anonymous disciples. That's pretty obvious. But of course, that is consistent with his anonymity through the rest of the gospel. And it corresponds, as you say, to his original appearance at the beginning as an anonymous character. And chapter 21 goes on to identify himself as that disciple.
So now we've talked for a little bit about the internal evidence for the authorship of John's gospel. What can we learn from the external evidence?
The external evidence, we have a number of references in the second century up to Irenaeus, really, at the end of the second century, which people have generally taken to refer to the John who wrote the gospel, but they've assumed that that John is meant to be John the son of Zebedee. Now, the earliest evidence we have about the gospels is that of Papias, and we only have fragments of his work, but Papias is talking about how he himself had been collecting gospel traditions in the late first century. So you would ask about what Andrew had said and what John had said. And then he would also ask about what John the Elder and Aristion, disciples of Jesus, were saying. There's a clear contrast between what the first group of disciples of Jesus had been saying, presumably they're now dead, and what these other two disciples of Jesus were saying at the time when Papias was inquiring, which is probably around the 80, that sort of period in the late first century. So here we have, accessible to Papias in Asia Minor, a John who was a disciple of Jesus, who was still alive, whereas the implication is that the better known John had by then already died. So we know of another disciple of Jesus called John. And he evidently, that title John the Elder is interesting. And if you look at the second and third epistles of John in the New Testament, the author of them calls himself the Elder, the Old One.
Now, you also interact with the writings of Polycrates, who mentions this John the Elder character, but also you say he's shown to be a member of the high priestly family. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, yes, Polycrates refers to the disciple who leaned on the breast of Jesus at the supper. So he's clearly referring to the beloved disciple. That's the disciple he means. And he says that he wore the high priestly headplate, the petalon, which is a technical term for something that only the high priest wore in his headdress. So if you want to say that someone officiated as high priest in the temple, you could say they wore the petalon. And it has to mean that. It can't mean anything else. People have tried to make it mean something much less than that. It must mean that he officiated as high priest in the Jerusalem temple. Now, how can Polycrates think the author of John's Gospel could have officiated as high priest? It's almost inconceivable that, you know, he really was high priest and that Polycrates got that right.
Richard Bauckham is so often on the right track that it's generally not wise to disagree with him. But here, I must admit that I do. Is it really inconceivable that the beloved disciple could have been a member of the high priestly family who officiated as high priest at one of the Jewish festivals before the temple was destroyed? It certainly is if you identify the beloved disciple with John, the fisherman from Galilee. But if this disciple was an anonymous Jerusalem follower of Jesus, who's to say whether or not he could have been connected to the priestly line? What if his name was intentionally kept out of the record as another example of protective anonymity because of his connection to the family of Annas and Caiaphas? With this question in the back of your mind, listen to the following words from John 18. After Jesus was arrested and led to the high priest's residence, verse 15 says that Simon Peter followed behind, along with another disciple. Here we should stop to notice the fact that this other disciple, who is completely unmentioned by the other gospel writers in this same scene, is unnamed here in John. Why is this? Well, the text goes on to say, quote, "Since this disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest, but Peter stood outside the door. So this other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the servant girl and brought Peter in." Who is this disciple? Why is he anonymous? And how exactly is he known to the high priest? The word known in Greek is gnostos, which is used of close friends and family members. According to C.H. Dodd, it is now generally recognized that here in John 18:15, the Greek word gnostos implies something more than mere acquaintance. It means that the person so described was a member of the high priest's circle, possibly a kinsman and himself of priestly birth, or at any rate, one who stood in intimate relations with the governing high priestly family. Perhaps then Polycrates wasn't mistaken after all. Polycrates, you see, served as a bishop in the city of Ephesus sometime in the middle to latter part of the 2nd century. And this also happened to be the same city in which John served as an elder less than a century earlier. In fact, it was also where he wrote his gospel. In my thinking, therefore, Polycrates wasn't likely to be mistaken. And when we study John's gospel closely, we see that not only was this unnamed disciple of Jesus known to the high priest, but that he also had the authority to let Peter into the gated courtyard of the high priest during this important late-night trial. Over the years, I've had a number of opportunities to talk with scholars who have written books related to the Gospel of John. And whenever I've done this, I've always thrown in a question about this verse from John 18. Here's my conversation with D.A. Carson. Dr. Carson, what's your view of the unnamed disciple who appears in John 18, who follows Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest, and then who later speaks to the servant girl and grants Peter access? Do you think this character is also the beloved disciple and thus the author of this gospel?
Probably, but not certainly. I think it's the simplest solution. I think that once John has adopted the strategy of not naming himself, but referring to him obliquely and commonly as the one whom Jesus loved, I think that that makes sense.
Now, since in your view this would be John the son of Zebedee, how do you account for the fact that according to verse 15 of John 18, that he was known to the high priest?
The Galilee fishing business provided food for the capital. And it may well be that John was one of those who had access to the courts of Jerusalem precisely because he acted in part for the family and sales and so on. I can't prove any of that, but it's a more reasonable speculation than the speculation that has to invent another unknown party.
But why would the high priest's fish salesman have the authority to grant Peter access into the court?
Well, it does not establish that the figure has the authority to let Peter in, but that he is known and therefore Peter is let in. It sounds much more like, hey, you know me. Can my friend come in here, please?
I also discussed this with Dr. Craig Blomberg, author of The Historical Reliability of John's Gospel.
Dr. Blomberg, what's your view of the unnamed disciple of John 18, who's known to the high priest and who also seems to have the authority to grant Peter access into the courtyard? Do you believe that this is the beloved disciple?
It certainly could be. You've got five places in the latter chapters of John where you have this strictly anonymous person called the disciple Jesus loved that the church has associated with the Apostle John since early days. But you also have a handful of other places where you just have an anonymous disciple, where you might expect a name to appear, but you don't. And if John the Apostle, as the writer, is being consistent in not referring to himself by name, he may be that person that you alluded to in chapter 18. Somebody had to provide the elders and high priests and governors with food, and the food, for the most part, came from Galilee. The best fish were consistently said to come from Galilee. Jerusalem is landlocked. It's almost as close to the Dead Sea as it is to the Jordan River, and it's complete speculation, but it's not recent speculation. Was John's family one of the suppliers of fish to the high priest's home? Is that how he knew him? It's not beyond the bounds of possibility.
All that is claimed there is that the high priest apparently knew who John was.
Andreas Kostenberger, research professor of New Testament at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary.
And so that enabled him to gain Peter access. This is part of the consistent portrayal of the author, which I believe to be John the Apostle, having superior access, superior even to the Apostle Peter. And so you see consistently that, say, in the upper room, Peter is turning to the beloved disciple to find out the identity of the betrayer. Or later on, the empty tomb, John outruns Peter and gets to the tomb first. Or even more maybe prominently in chapter 21, it's John who recognizes Jesus and says, "It's the Lord." And then Peter jumps into the lake. And so I think there's this consistent holy one-upmanship, you might say, where John tries to boost his credentials as a witness, if you will, and shows that in some ways he was even closer to the source than Peter. And so if you place that reference in John 18 within that larger picture that, again, Peter can't even get into the high priest's courtyard without John's help.
But how do you think John, the son of Zebedee, would have been known to the high priest?
You know, we just have to consider the possibility that John had personal acquaintance. You know, his father had a fishing business with several employees and so forth, which we need to realize that in Galilee, fishing was one of the major industries. So this is not just some sort of marginal, you know, business he was engaged in.
I don't know of any independent evidence that only a resident would generally have the social ability to get the servant girl to let someone in. It's really who you know.
Lydia McGrew, author of Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and Acts.
So she sees him in and out. She thinks well of him. He was maybe the youngest of the disciples since he lived to quite an old age. So you could think of him as the kid who delivers the fish. The kid, maybe I'm being a little exaggerated, but, you know, he's in his late teens or something like that. She lets him in. Then he can say, "Oh, this guy's fine. He's a friend of mine. Let him in." Again, it's a society where influence is what matters.
Okay, so now once he grants access to Peter there in the courtyard of the high priest, where do you think the beloved disciple goes from there?
Looks like he follows Jesus to the cross. I mean, I think we're agreed on that because that's what we find in John 19.
But before he gets to the cross, I guess my question to you would be whether you would see the beloved disciple as the primary witness to the trial that's going on here, as well as to the conversation that happens later on with Pilate.
I think he was probably one of the witnesses with Pilate. He may have been one of the witnesses here. What I do think we have reason to think is that there were multiple witnesses. One of them might have just been someone who converted from the priestly class. We know in Acts that there were members of the priestly class who converted.
Okay, so at this point, I've got a couple of questions. If this is one of the witnesses to Jesus' interrogation before the chief priests or Pilate, why would a teenage fish salesman be allowed into proceedings like that? And then secondly, why are the other Gospels completely silent about the Apostle John's presence from this point here, you know, in the courtyard of the high priest, all the way to the time in which he's given the custody of Jesus' mother Mary there at the foot of the cross?
Okay, so let's start with he was in the inner trial. He was there. He was a witness of it. That is an inference. We don't know that. Number two, if he was there, then he had to be someone more important. He had to be someone closer to the high priest. And at this point, we're multiplying your improbabilities. So I'm not going to hold myself responsible to answer a question. Hey, why was he definitely allowed into this trial if they didn't know him really well? There's all kinds of suppositions going on there. Now, as far as why they didn't mention him as a witness, I believe that Balcom and those who argue from that have the exact same problem themselves. If he was this person who was important to the early church, he was the disciple Jesus loved, he was in that sense an important witness, I think the very same question arises. Why don't they mention this disciple at the foot of the cross in the synoptics? Well, people just don't mention things sometimes.
All four of the scholars you heard from agreed that the unnamed disciple of John 18 was the beloved disciple, and therefore also happened to be the author of the fourth gospel. But since they believed that this also happened to be the apostle John, they ended up arguing that the best explanation for John 18:15 was that because John was a fisherman, he likely sold fish to the high priestly family. So I asked Richard Bauckham what he thought of this interpretation.
It's not only a weak hypothesis, it's nonsense. The Zebedee family would have sold their fish to the local market in Galilee. It's inconceivable that their fish would have gone to the high priest. The fish trade didn't happen like that. And, you know, my recently published book on Magdala in Galilee, dominating the fishing industry. You know, it's a very long chapter about the Galilean fishing industry. And there's no way that a Capernaum fisherman would have supplied the high priest. It makes no sense in the economy of the fish trade at that time.
On the last episode, Dr. Bauckham made an interesting point about the transition that occurs in Mark's gospel from the witness of Peter and the 12 on the day of Jesus' crucifixion to the testimony of the female disciples. After Jesus' arrest the previous night, according to Mark's gospel, all the disciples fled and were nowhere to be seen during the crucial events of his death, burial, and resurrection. Numerous texts from the Gospels and Acts indicate that Jesus specifically appointed the 12 to be his witnesses, since they had been with him from the beginning. And yet, at the most crucial part of the story, Mark ends up relying on several female eyewitnesses who essentially fill in for the apostles, who have all fled at this point in the narrative. As Richard Bauckham pointed out, Mark presents their testimony in a series of words connected to verbs of seeing. They were looking on from a distance at the time of crucifixion, and they saw the tomb in which Jesus' body had been placed. On Sunday morning, they were the first to discover the tomb empty, and they reported seeing an angel who told them that Jesus had risen from the dead. This should lead us to ask, why would Mark and the other synoptic authors leave John's apostolic testimony out of their records? Richard Bauckham writes, "The point is not that Mark fails to mention John's presence at the cross, but that he doesn't introduce him as an eyewitness. Why should Mark resort to the women for testimony if one of the 12 could have supplied it?" When I put this question to Lydia McGrew, she replied by saying that sometimes authors just don't mention things. But the apostles were specifically called to be Jesus' witnesses, and in a culture in which the testimony of women wasn't valued, are we to imagine that the gospel writers simply failed to mention John's presence there during this crucial period? Now, if we take John 18:15 at face value, that the beloved disciple was somehow connected with the high priestly family, and if we take the words of Polycrates seriously, that the author of the fourth gospel at one point wore the sacred pedalon, I believe this could explain why the testimony of the beloved disciple was left out of the earlier Gospels, and why, when this disciple himself decided to write his own Gospel, he kept his name out of the record. It was another case of protective anonymity. Unfortunately, when I discussed my view with Richard Bauckham, he didn't seem to be terribly impressed. Here's that part of our conversation.
It's almost inconceivable that, you know, he really was high priest and that Polycrates got that right.
unless you take the words of John 18 seriously, if this unknown disciple there in John 18, 15 is a member of the high priestly family, and he is the author of the gospel, that would seem to match with what Polycrates is saying.
Yes, but, you know, we know all the high priests were from the time of Caiaphas, the time of Jesus. We know all the high priests were down to the destruction of the temple, and none of them are called John. And it would be very, very difficult to explain how a disciple of Jesus could have officiated as high priest in the Jerusalem temple. I mean, how could that have happened?
Well, here's one way that I think it could have happened. Let's just say for a moment that one of the younger members of the high priestly family did end up becoming sympathetic to Jesus and his mission. Perhaps he had officiated at the temple once or twice as a kind of stand-in for the high priest due to an illness or some kind of ceremonial uncleanness. The word for this kind of a stand-in was called a sagan and was not at all uncommon. Perhaps then this is the man who offered his Jerusalem home with its large upper room to Jesus and his disciples on the night of the Last Supper. And perhaps Jesus even encouraged him to keep a low profile, since eventually he would be entrusted with the care of his own mother. Now, when Richard Bauckham says we know all the names of the high priests who served until the temple's destruction, and that none of them were called John, he's simply not correct. The high priest Annas had five sons, and one of them was named John. In fact, he's specifically mentioned by name in Acts 4:6. But according to Josephus, this particular John was assassinated while he was serving as high priest, and therefore doesn't qualify to be the author of the fourth gospel. Over the past century or more, some scholars who have entertained this thesis that the beloved disciple may have been a member of the high priestly family have argued that perhaps there was a John whose name was effectively erased from the record in light of his confession that Jesus was the promised Messiah. After looking into this closely, I believe these scholars were onto something, because I ended up discovering evidence that there was, in fact, another member of the high priestly family named John whose name was unmentioned by Josephus or any other ancient Jewish record related to the family of high priests. Though this individual's name has been forgotten for the past 2,000 years or more, it recently came to light through the discovery of a fascinating archaeological artifact that was uncovered in recent decades. This entire subject is related to one of the book projects that I'm currently working on, but I've decided to write a brief article about the connection between this particular artifact and my own thesis about the identity of the beloved disciple. If you're interested in this, you'll find a link to read my forthcoming article in the show notes.
Well, whatever your view of the authorship, one thing is clear. The author of this gospel doesn't reveal his name to his readers, and this you take as evidence that this is not what we call pseudepigrapha or a kind of ancient version of fan fiction. Why do you say that?
It does seem unlikely. I mean, you would think that somebody writing a fictional account and, as it were, pretending to be a disciple of Jesus, you would think they would, as it were, make more of that claim within the story. And of course, all the other later apocryphal gospels are ascribed to well-known figures like Peter or James or Thomas, or, you know, they weren't ascribed to unknown or little-known figures. So it doesn't look to me like pseudepigraphy. And the other thing is, I don't think the gospel was ever anonymous in the sense that people didn't wrote it, because I do think titles of the gospels go back to an early period. I think the titles of the gospels date at least from when these gospels started circulating around, and people want to know who wrote them. I mean, one thing the anonymity does is to distinguish him from all the other characters in the story, so that you think there's something special about him. You know, he's not just one of the characters in the story. There's something else about this man. And he's not just an anonymous character who doesn't matter. He's clearly an important character whose name is not given you. So it distinguishes him. And I think at the end of the gospel, you realize he's distinguished because he's the author and witnessed these things and then wrote them down. Precisely because he was not well known. He was not known in the way that Peter and those whose traditions about Jesus had already become known in the church. And so in a sense, he has to establish his credentials. And so you learn about how he came to know Jesus, how close he was to Jesus. You learn all these things about him without being distracted by, you know, who's this character called John. So it may be a way of establishing his credentials.
folks, thanks so much for joining me for this edition of the Humble Skeptic Podcast. As always, if you'd like to investigate this topic further, as always, be sure to check out the show notes for this episode at humbleskeptic.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the link to my forthcoming article on the identity of the beloved disciple, which includes information about the discovery of this fascinating archaeological artifact. For those of you in or near the St. Louis area, I'll be speaking at an apologetics-related conference this weekend with Greg Kokel and Jeremy Smith, and you can find information about that in the show notes as well. Once again, the web address is humbleskeptic.com. That's humbleskeptic.com, and I look forward to being with you again next time as we discuss the beliefs and ideas that shape our lives.